This is Zitalili Christofumsnelly, and he is from southern Africa. The proper name for that part of Africa is Azania, and we're looking forward to the time when it can be identified and called by its proper name. That, of course, will take place in what people on the southern tip of the continent call post-liberation. I'm Will Hertzfeld. Both Zitalili and I are from the Bay Area. Zitalili is a graduate student at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. And when he is not doing that, he is the visiting pastor from Southern Africa at Bethlehem Lutheran Church. I'm the pastor of the church for the most part, except that Zitalili agrees with me that he's now a long way towards having Bethlehem Lutheran Church become the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Southern Africa, exiled in Oakland.
Now we are talking.
Zitalili and I have enjoyed much conversation about many things, and since Holden Village is the kind of place where people engage in conversation, meaningful conversation, we thought that we would share bits and pieces of our dialogue with you. That will be done rather briefly. We understand that this is a forum, and we thought that you would give us a chance to dialogue together with you, either with your questions or with your responses. Let me begin by saying that Africa, the African continent, has always been of interest to me. However, that interest has not really been related to the fact that I was of African heritage. My first experiences with the African continent was when I went to the Lincoln Theater in Mobile, Alabama, every Saturday, and paid hard-earned money to see Tarzan movies. I'm well aware of the fact that Edgar Rice Burroughs was not an African, and it was a small wonder then that the main character of the movie, Tarzan, and then later on, in order to complete, I guess, certain whitenized understandings of what the nuclear family is all about, Jane conveniently got lost in the African jungle. And I remember when Jane first got removed from the Tarzan movies, because if you recall, there was a great deal of questions raised about whether or not Tarzan and Jane should be appearing in the same movie together in view of the fact that they had not been married. At least they had not been brought before a priest or had taken out license and those kinds of things, which, of course, could not be done in the jungle. But anyway, I really got wrapped up in those movies, and I suspect that there was a kind of subliminal attraction for me in them. My second exposure to talk about and concern for Africa happened when our Sunday school took up offerings for African missions. And we were then given straw mats and gifts from Africa. I always wondered why it was that a black church in Tilden, Alabama, with a one-room school and holes in the roof and all of these kinds of appointments would send money to Africa. I often thought that the missionaries should probably take up offerings to get the roof fixed on the church. and not be too concerned about African missions. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod at that time, though, had already determined that we would have a connection with Africa, because all of the missionaries who were later on to be sent to West Africa, in particular Nigeria, were passed through Alabama and Georgia and Mississippi. The point being that if the missionaries could survive the heat and the flies and the clay roads and the black people of the South, then they would be psychologically and physiologically prepared to do mission work in Africa. So I suppose that it would be all right if I claimed to have trained more than one missionary for Africa, for which I will have to ask the forgiveness of my African sisters and brothers.
Day of reckoning.
There were also certain other kinds of stereotypical understandings that I had about Africans, and I'll share this one vignette with you, and then Zitalele will probably want to share either his rebuttal or nervous reaction to some of the things that I've just said. I think you ought to be aware of the fact, though, that I've said much more than you have actually heard me say. That's my serious note. My first time on the African continent, and I never shall forget it, was an overnight flight from New York to Dakar, Senegal. We were in the company of five or six other African American theologians and church people. We were going to Africa to engage in a dialogue with what was then identified as the East Africa contingent of the Association of All African Churches. When we got off the plane in several of these African states, the one place that would be of interest to you would be Nairobi, Kenya. They had a reporter from Time Magazine meeting that flight, and when we got off the plane, the reporter was thoroughly confused, because we got off the plane with wild hairdos and bones hanging around our necks and dashikis and all these kinds of things, and the Africans who met us were wearing Brooks Brothers suits. and the Time Magazine reporter asked the question, expletive deleted, "Who are the Africans here?" We thought that African Americans were coming to Africa, and they would be therefore getting off the plane, and that they would be met by Africans. Standing outside of a slave thing in Bagamoyo, Tanzania, I tried very, very, very hard to identify with that place. It's a place where slaves were brought from the inland out to the coast by Persian slave traders, and subsequently shipped off to Europe and to America. And I really could not feel much affinity with Africa, even though I was standing now in the African sun on African soil. But from within that old prison, I heard the cry of an infant, and I saw children run out of that old prison. These people were squatters, and I remember somebody raising a camera to get a picture of that scene, and I remember knocking the camera out of that person's hand. And that's when I knew I was home. Well, that's enough of that. The thing that Zitalele and I have talked about are two things. One of them, of course, is the critical differences between the colonial experience and the slave experience. We might want to talk a little bit about that this evening. Another thing that we have talked about is the differences between, quotes, African liberation theology, South African style, and black liberation theology, African-American style. There are a number of other things that we talk about, but we'll try to keep them secret until we are trustful that this is going to be a lively and invigorating discussion. Zitalele?
Thank you, Walden. One of the reasons where there is some kind of rivalry between us, I'm sure you have already spotted that, arises from the fact that, you know, Will tends to be one up on me. I remember in 1973 I took a plane from Johannesburg to Frankfurt, Germany, and we stopped over in Nairobi. Now I wanted to get out and see Nairobi a little bit. I was told since I was carrying the green passport, which is a South African passport, I couldn't go beyond the terminal. And he has been there. He has celebrated birthdays back there. So now that's why I want to move him out of Bethlehem Lutheran and take it so that it becomes, you know, my parish in exile. Maybe by way of retaliation. To come back to the issues, I thought probably I'll start off today with a personal observation between my stay in the United States. I've been in the United States on two terms now. The first term was a two-year term beginning 73 through 75 when I was up back in the Midwest. There's something that relates to the dialogue that we're about, you know, the dialogue between African and Afro-American observations or reflections. One thing I noted when I was back in the Midwest was that there was some kind of tension, perhaps arising from the fact that, you know, the Midwest is different from the West Coast, you know, because I found myself at a loss because most black folk back there would not talk to me. Maybe because they just didn't know me at the time, and they just wondered how I happened to be back at the seminary that only had the second African and had never had a black American. You know, this was an ALC seminary at Capital University, as it was then called. It's now called Trinity Seminary. So my relationship with my own people then, I mean, since I was kind of a quote-unquote token, was a bit tense. And I tended to interpret it on that basis. However, when I came back here on the West Coast in 1977 with my family, again I met a different sort of black. And that was encouraging for once, since, you know, I then could fellowship. I tried to visit black churches in the Midwest, but it just didn't work. In the Bay Area, I served as an interim pastor of an LCA parish, St. Philip's, the summer of 78. And my relationship with the congregation, since I was full-time minister at the time, was very good. To say nothing of Bethlehem Lutheran, because, I mean, it's true that it's really my parish. With those kind, I mean, the differences there then are kind of really pointed at that point. So much for the light side of things. Let's get down to business. With respect to black theology as a project, generally in Africa there is a kind of polarization that is on now between Africans to the north of the Republic and Africans from the Republic of South Africa. Most Africans to the north, and I'm thinking of people like Mbiti, for example, and others, tend to be polarized against the project of black theology. claiming then the pretext that, you know, they have never been in enslavement, and also being preoccupied with what I call Western models of doing theology. Consequently, there is a notion there that, you know, theology is something that should be neutral. You know, you can't have a black theology because that would be colonial theology. Whereas in Southern Africa, because of the problems of being a Christian in an apartheid society, the issue of liberation theology is prominent. And for that sense, then there's a great sense of affinity between the Black American theological project and our own South African black theology. I mentioned earlier in my talk that, for example, even within our own budding black consciousness movement, one of the incentives directly responsible for that were people like Jim Cohn, for example, with his work on black theology and black power. It really made headlines in South Africa, and incidentally, it was banned immediately. And so was Martin Luther King's stride towards freedom. All those were banned. And again, it shows the kind of polarity that exists between the Christian community of Southern Africa, the white Christian community on the one hand, and black Christians on the other. And again, to move away from theology, and perhaps we can pursue the matter as in dialogue, I'd like to just touch on and then stop at that point and react to questions on what Will has entitled the problem between colonialism as an institution and slavery or slave institution on the other. Judging by what has happened through in the United States, and when I begin by what has happened in the United States, I'm referring to the Civil War. For me, the Civil War, represents a milestone because it was white folk against white folk who sought to go to war primarily to change the situation which they then recognized was an anomaly. And that has not occurred in South Africa at all. And it's pretty significant for me that that did take place. And then, of course, I would jump over to the time of the late 50s, early 60s, when the civil rights movement in the United States gained prominence. And that, again, for me, represents another significant milestone in that for the second time now, they evolve in American institution, some kind of Bill of Rights in the name of the Civil Rights Act. And that again has not occurred in South Africa at all. Those are two very significant things that have happened and has consequently made the black cause here much more palatable than it is in South Africa. That's one major difference. Another difference is the fact that, you know, colonialism and in fact imperialism in the Republic of South Africa is much more ruthless, so that the system that we are under, for me, is worse than being slaves. Because at least if we were called slaves, then we would know that, and even the world would accept and probably would have had South Africa under sanctions by now if they had described their institution of apartheid, which is separation of races, as a slave institution. A question was raised yesterday as to how the system of apartheid operates in terms of racial delimitation or delineation. The hierarchy goes as follows. On the upper echelon, you have whites. They are number one citizens in the Republic of South Africa, 4.5 million of them. Second would be the people of mixed color. We call them blacks. They used to be called coloreds, but like here in the United States, they resent the term colored for right reasons. Then third, South African Asians, predominantly Indians from India, who break down into two groups, really. They break down to the Islam community, which is much more, has more opportunities by virtue of the fact that, you know, most of them were Pakistanis, and they came into the Republic, into South Africa around about 1860, to provide, to be merchants to the indentured laborers, Indian laborers, who mostly of whom are Hindus, who were working, were brought in then to work in the sugarcane fields when the black population refused to work in the sugarcane fields. Then black or Africans comprise then the fourth class citizenship of the Republic. That again epitomizes the kind of problem that it is to be black in South Africa. Consequently, if you move into the work and the job market, for example, you compete with all those interests. Another interesting thing is that the Islamic community, Asian community, has sort of gone a step further than the people of mixed blood, because South African Indians are very good merchants. And by that fact, they have been, and also due directly to the work that Gandhi was responsible for during the Indian Congress towards the turn of the century, he sensitized Indian merchants to begin to use their economic muscle power to climb the ladder, the hierarchical ladder of South Africa, so that in essence, really, economically, they are second-class citizens. And the people of mixed blood have been relegated to the third-class citizen for economic reasons, because there are very few rich colored people in South Africa. Most of them have the same plight as black Africans. If you go, for example, in the wineries of the Cape, you find that there are a lot of the so-called quote-unquote poor coloreds, some of whom are really even poorer than Africans, and also work under the same conditions. If you were reading the news just last year, toward the end of the year, there was a big resettlement thing in Cape Town in a place called District 6, where a lot of the people of mixed blood were being moved from a slum area into another place, and people like David Russell, one of the Anglican priests or Episcopalian priests there, was arrested for protesting the removal of District 6 to another residential area. Because District 6 was so close to Cape Town, they just could not afford the ghetto, and therefore they demolished ghetto or slum, and had the people moved elsewhere. And for protesting that, then David Russell made headlines, both in Europe, especially with the London Times and papers like Le Monde, because that made international news, since he was arrested and detained. That, in a nutshell, is how the system of apartheid operates and segregates black against black, and white against black, Asian against white. It's just that, a complicated system of segregation. I think with those kinds of remarks, I will stop and react to some kind of questions from the floor.
What language do these different people use?
Which?
Language in South Africa?
The general language of South Africa is English, South African English. Yeah. It's more like Australian English. Basically, even if you move, in urban South Africa, even black Africans, elderly persons from among the African population would minimally know English, because since some of them work as a... I think the word would be undocumented workers, and doing things like gardening, house cleaning, carrying groceries, for example, for the whites there. And people like that have minimal English. There are three black languages, major languages. There would be Zulu, Xhosa. They don't fit at all because they are
What are they considered?
Honorary whites.
It depends. If you're Japanese, you're honorary white. If you're Chinese, you're honorary white. But if you are Asian from India or Pakistan, then you're second class citizen in South Africa.
The Chinese are considered white.
Yeah. And the Japanese.
That's very similar to how it was in certain sections of the United States when there were only two racial categories, literally listed.
An interesting thing, for example, is that if Will visited me back there, then they make him an honorary white so that he needs a permit to get to where I am. It's really crazy. Yes, ma'am.
It seems to me that the white people down there are trying to keep power at all costs.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it be wise for them to make some kind of alliance with the Asian peoples? Why don't they do that? I mean, it would certainly solidify their power base. Are they just too narrow-minded to do that, or why are they so reluctant to do that?
The problem is that, if you talk about the dominant, there are 4.5 million whites, 2.5 of whom were Africana or the Boer. They are so preoccupied with exclusive apartheid or racial segregation to the extent that they even are suspicious of the English speaking South African. So that in the so-called liberalizing policy of Prime Minister P.W. Botha, he speaks of Asians and people of mixed color, mixed race, as mixed blood, I beg your pardon. They have now, according to the new so-called proposed constitutional arrangement, they will have a consultative body where we should be exclusively Asian and colored. But this consultative body then talks to the white minister of colored affairs as well as the white minister of Asian affairs. That is called then liberalizing of policy. Everything else is segregated. Residential lots, for example, are allocated according to race. They have no parliamentary representation at all. So that, this quasi-liberalization is also in part trying to say, we realize that, it's going to be very difficult to defend this long border, so we need to make friends. But we don't even know how to make friends, as you said.
Yeah, they're not really broadening their power base.
Nothing at all. Nothing at all. I think what is going to happen in not so distant a future, we're going to see some kind of serious fragmentation within the white population of South Africa. The English are already showing a lot of despondency with this system. I may just say in passing that way back in 1961, when South Africa became a republic, during May 29, when there was a big referendum, Natal, which is predominantly English speaking, the Mitchell family, which was really, were representatives in parliament in Cape Town of that constituency, had come in and pledged with ANC that they were going to pull Natal out of the referendum. But that, for ulterior motives and lobbying by Dr. Verwoerd then, the Mitchell brothers had second thoughts and they did not do that and they let us down. But I think in not so distant the future, there's going to be a serious conflict between the English population of Southern Africa and the rest of the black population of Southern Africa. And by black here, I mean colored, Asian, and African. I think that is in the making. It's going to happen. I can point to, for example, defector syndrome. The highest military defectors in Southern Africa are mostly English speaking. And there's quite a lot of those now. In fact, in London, there is now a concerted effort, including using radio, to throw in some kind of pressure and make the English-speaking South African to defect much more at a higher rate. And they have even organized themselves into a group in EXA.
Okay. Here and then here.
When you say English-speaking South African, do you mean the white South African?
Yeah, white.
Okay, and you're talking about white against white, you know?
It's going to happen.
Yeah, okay. So, in that sense, it'd be just like in this country. Mm-hmm. The Civil War, certainly now, and maybe part like today also.
I don't want to extend it too much, but it is a factor that, you know, I mean, it's going to precipitate pretty soon, because there's a lot of tension. People are realizing that, you know, I mean, what the present government is doing is really can easily lead to national genocide. There's a lot of tension. It's only a question of time before it begins to precipitate into a crisis. Yes, Larry.
I think I'm next. I think, Will, didn't you turn to somebody
else? He's next, and then you, Larry. And Dwayne. And then
somebody behind that.
All right, now we got four in a row, so let's go.
What's the composition of the South African military, the army? What is the racial composition?
Exclusively white. There are a few colored people serving in the army as army cadets, you know, and they have no training at all.
And how many people can make up the army?
The cadets? I can't give you a numerical breakdown of that.
Oh, you don't know how many people are in the whole South African army as...
No, I don't know that. I don't know that. But it's heavily white.
Oh.
Yeah.
Larry?
I have two different questions. One is, are there any alliances between anti-apartheid whites and the black community? Or is that also a area of much tension where for blacks, it's two different groups of whites, but both of them are standing in the way. That's one question. The other one is quite different, and that is, what is the character of South African and Black American dialogue in theology? I mean, get a hold of Jim Collins' books and read them, even though they're banned? Do you meet as the Third World Ecumenical Organization of Third World Theologians? That's just another question of what actual contacts there are, whether by way of people or by way of material.
Yeah, I'll start with your last question, since it's easier to answer. The contact between the Black Theology Project here and the South African Black Theology thing is very solid. First, when we first published the essays on edited by Basil Moore, entitled Black Theology, South African Voice, published by Colin Collins, and also published by John Knox Press here. The James Cone has two articles in there, because he agreed to be a consultant of our Black Theology Project when we began the project in 1969. And there has been contact between people like, for example, Desmond Tutu, and Bishop Manas Buthelezi constantly with Jim Cone and other black theologians, but predominantly Jim Cone. And the reason for that is that Jim Cone, unlike, you know, other thinkers of his caliber, for example, if you read Marx, there's, you know, early Marx, there's later Marx, you read Heidegger, it's the same thing, you know, there's early Heidegger and later Heidegger. What at this point is good with Jim Cone, he has maintained his initial motive of black theology at a great cost, including other black theologians attacking him as some kind of particularizing the theological project too much. But for us, that has been very significant, because there is all kinds of liberation theologies, even though I look at them as theology, people have tended to, for example, to expand and enjoy liberation theology from Asia, liberation theology from Latin America, and a lot of people, in fact, even coursework. You find that, you know, when I was in the seminary at in Columbus, for example, there was a project on liberation theology, the Latin American expression, and I was really confounded since there was nothing about black theology, you know. So there was a sense that people were moving away from Cone because they I don't know what were the reasons of that.
Well, and, white Americans prefer having their food served and also their theological discussions. They prefer accents.
Uh-huh.
And yes. And then you see it's quite easy for. For theologians, white theologians in this country, to talk about Latin America. Mm-hmm. It'll become quite fashionable for them to talk about Southern Africa. Mm-hmm. That way one does not have to deal with that which is as close to them as their deodorant, black theology.
I hear that.
You see, because black theology and all of its reflections is de facto a production of the not-so-creative tensions and dialogue between blacks and whites in America. It represents nerve failure on the one hand and an almost total cessation of dialogue on the other. It's clearly much more fashionable to talk about something that's some distance away but yet doesn't affect you. That's how, incidentally, Zitalili, the Black Theology Project of theology in the Americas began. It was not initially a part of the dialogue. Ever since liberation theology, and incidentally, Jim Cone's book was written before Gustavo Gutierrez's book.
I know that.
And most people don't realize that. But a whole group of Latin American theologians were invited to Detroit to discuss liberation theology with white American theologians. But no black theologians of any significance at all were invited to those discussions. In fact, black theology was not even on the agenda. Mm-hmm. And it was after some demonstrations and other kinds of things that went along with activities of blacks in this country that black theology then became a part of the dialogue. And consequently, then, the Association of Third World, the Ecumenical Association of Third World Theologians began with black American theology as the godfather, as it is, as you have pointed it out, as black theology is the godfather of liberation theology in Southern Africa. Mm-hmm. Along with, of course, the writings of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, which we contend is all a part of the genesis and finally the identification of black theology in this country. Mm-hmm. Cone's systematizing of it doesn't mean that he popularized it, but his becomes the primary responsibility of articulating it, you know, in a systematic way. But that's why.
Okay.
That's why you would encounter liberation theology talk at Capitol, mm-hmm. Involving Latin Americans, but involving no black Americans.
And then to end that question, I would like to refer to the recent book by Wilmore and Jim Cone, entitled, you know, Documentary History of Black Theology. That's a good text if you really want to see the dialogue between South African black theology and
right.
And all of our prominent black theologians are featured in that book. Alan Busack, Manas Buthelezi, Bishop Tutu. It's published by Obris Press.
It's called Black Liberation Theology, a Documentary History.
1969
through 79.
To move into your second question as to alliances between white South Africans and black South Africans, and black including all the non-white people, there is, and there has always been. When I presented the social history, I tried by all means to show that the South African struggle has never been segregated when it comes to liberation motif. The ANC has factions inside of liberal Jews English-speaking people, I think even to a sense there are some African-speaking people, you know, who empathize with the cause, with that cause. At one time, people like Van der Post, for example, who is a Jungian and a correspondent of
he's a what?
British, he's an Afrikaner.
Yeah.
Yeah, born in Cape Town. And he left the country after World War I and then settled in England and works with some major radio, I mean, thing in London now. He himself was very empathic to what was then called the Union Movement. That was the effort then of people to try to unify the struggle, you know, the Indian Congress, African National Congress, and other groups. Within our own black, where there is a sense of polarity right now, is even though that is not true, because if you read Wood's book, for example, you would see that even within our own black consciousness movement, of which I was part, which was really sparked off by what I call our reaction to white liberalism in Southern Africa. For example, at Staddenham in 1968, as I see it now in retrospect, what was happening at Staddenham, there was a head-on collision between black power on the one hand and English liberal or Jewish people on the one hand. We just could not go together. And we decided to part company. And there was a lot of polarization, for example. I remember at our first black theology project at Natal University, the black section of the medical school, a lot of whites really picketed our project, you know, with their slogans from NUSAS, which is the National Union of Students in South Africa, which was quasi-integrated at that time, but had fragmented by legislation that, you know, I mean, white students just couldn't mix with blacks. They picketed because they thought we were beginning to pigment theology, you know, to colonize theology. And for a while, we were highly polarized. In fact, at our meetings, we would even exclude the liberal press of South Africa because we felt that they were playing a negative role at that point in time. But I think there's a lot of goodwill on both sides, that if those people would really mean that we want to be on your side and do like people like Woods have done, for example, there can be some kind of quasi-alliance building from that.
Dwayne? And then that's Tom, isn't it?
Okay. Insightful as Larry is, he asked a question that I was going to ask. referring to communication between theologies, and it sparked something else listening to your dialogue there. When you mentioned that white Americans do not take into heart or take into consideration North American black theology because it's too close to home, it's too uncomfortable. I think you're probably right. It brings to mind something that a Canadian theologian has just said in reference to Christology, Douglas John Hall, after reading Shusako Endo's Silence, said that we have to look for an image of Christ elsewhere than in North America. And by saying that, he was avoiding, you know, the North American black experience. I wonder how you would respond to that.
Well, yeah, I
back up also saying that because the North American image of Jesus is just too macho. Would you say that can be shared as well by black American theologians, or is there another reason?
Well, I'm familiar with Douglas John Hall's statement about finding Jesus somewhere other than in America. And I remember responding to that same question a couple of weeks ago with a story. It just took me a minute to tell the story. There was this guy who decided that he would hide behind a piano so that he could find out who was visiting his house when he was away. And not just visiting his house, but consorting with his wife. And as he he positioned himself behind the piano, and sure enough, this person, this man, comes in, and he walks into the door, quoting poetry, saying things like, "Sweetheart, I can see all the way to India, and you are there, and I can see the Great White Wall of China, and you are there." And he just went on a trip, you know, and he saw her everywhere. And then this guy stands up from behind the piano with a shotgun, and he says, "Now I'm about to erase you, kill you. But I'm not going to kill you for having a key to my house. I'm not going to kill you for coming into this house and consorting with my wife. I'm going to kill you because you can see so damn far, and you can't see me behind this piano." Do you understand what I... I believe that that Light in Our Darkness is one of the greatest works directed towards white church renewal that I can think of. But I emphasize white church renewal. But there is only a point at which one can go if one is, say, of the particular and peculiar stripe of Douglas John Hall. And then that's the way I would answer the question in the first part. Second part, now I'll get a chance to share a story. There is a black Christ out here. It's funny. The black Christ was carved by Terry Saturn. Who was an iron sculptor, lived here in the village for a number of years. And the little brother or sister, depending on however, you know, how you want to look at it, to that is my pectoral cross. And now my son and Zitaleli's sons desecrated the black Christ because of this nonsense that we were all engaged in. Summer solstice, I believe. But I can remember saying here in 1969 that Jesus is black, and that the black Christ is an open one. Check it out, you know. All through the years. The black Jesus has welcomed white people into its community, sometimes for good and sometimes for ill. Cone says in Black Theology and Black Power, "Let a white person deny," quotes, "himself, herself, whiteness, take up his," Jim said "his" in those days, but we say "his, her." The changes are with permission. take up his, her cross, blackness, and follow me, says Jesus, to the ghetto. The American ghetto. Indeed, the USA black ghetto. Now, it sounds arrogant, but we believe that if white Americans are to engage in authentic dialogue with peoples of the world, and if they are to discover and be brought to repentance and conversion by any Christ, it will probably be the black Christ or the red Christ or and Vine DeLoria and Myers and Dennis Banks and some of the others say, well, since blacks are tenants in this land too, maybe they ought to, try the red one. That one might be even more difficult than the black one. In other words, I don't think that we need to go to Japan or Africa, or Southern Africa, or China, or to people have been talking about Michener's book, here. I don't think we need to go to all those places to find the Christ who's not antithetical to, but who's really, really, you know, ready to baptize the church. That Christ is within the borders of the United States of America. Now, of course, that Christ, I think, oftentimes gets revealed by an African. You know, could be Zitalele C. Umzinelli, or it could be Kunta Kinte, or it could be, you know, some other African. But the revelation of that Christ is where that Christ is here. So we're, you know, we're still kind of upset about that. And there are a couple of other things that, you know, that bother black theological thinkers on this score. But that would be, you know, the biggie in response to your question, Dwayne. Now, Zitalele probably wants to say something, then we'll have time. Huh?
Since our time is almost up,
we'll get to you, Tom.
I'd like to say just one word with what I call, I'm busy now in my work doing what I call the opening of the brackets in terms of changing theological models or paradigms. One of the encouraging things, and probably better at one time, I hope, if I don't develop it into my thesis, I will work on a short article in a theological journal, possibly the theological journal that they publish in South Africa, is what happened in 1977 at the Lutheran World Federation Conference. We have talked here about our bonds between Afro and African, Afro-American dialogue. I think also there is a third front to this. There is some encouraging things that are happening within the Lutheran family, beginning with this, the statement, Status Confessionis, that was developed in Dar es Salaam LWF conference. The statement is a Latin form of a phrase for to make the issue of apartheid an issue of confession. Lutherans decided that, you know, I mean, conference, and I'm talking of Lutherans of all persuasions, agreed at that conference to endorse the resolution that make the whole institution of apartheid an issue of faith, such as they did within the Bamen Declaration, for example, during the World War II or the extermination of the Jews in Germany. That, to me, represents, even though it may be at this point, just a tiny light at the end of a tunnel, an encouraging broadening of what I call the brackets. Because for the first time, Lutherans of all colors agreed to do one thing as a family. And perhaps that speaks well of Lutheranism at that point, since most of us here are Lutherans. And I hope we'll take Status Confessionis seriously and begin to read the statement to our congregation and really rethink what that statement means. It has been enacted within the two major historical Lutheran bodies, namely ALC and the LCA, by resolutions of divestment coupled with incentives for pushing for economic sanctions, selective economic sanctions against South Africa. Recently, for example, this spring, the ALC Finance Board had a statement that they've discovered a way to really withdraw all their funds from firms that still support or prop the apartheid state without hurting the finances and the dividends of the people that are invested in those pension funds. Which was very encouraging, because there again we saw moving away from the resolutions that were taken at national conferences last year to begin to deliver on that score. And I was very pleased with that, and it shows movement. My only anticipation and expectation is that whilst that oils my wounds, I would appreciate if we would do further and really press on the issue of economic sanctions, because it remains the only thing possible if we are to have evolutionary change or peaceful change in Southern Africa.
Okay. Tom, we'll take 3 minutes and try to get you.
He talked about not needing to go very far to figure out what's going on. I was wondering if you could quickly take turns and comment on what you think about white Americans who are interested in working for social justice and for racial equality, but think obviously that the place to do that is in Latin America or Southern Africa or South Africa, instead of staying here.
Let me just comment on that one first. I always say that the world needs white missionaries more than it's ever needed them before. But it needs them differently than it's ever had them before. And I suspect that if I might be just intensely personal and say, Tom, if you feel a need to go to Africa or Latin America or someplace to clean up what some of your forebears dirtied up, then go with God. The other part of the statement is like unto that. There was a time when white people asked, when should we leave the black community? And our response would be, you should have left yesterday. But then there were others who never asked the question, and they are still in the black community, at home, working, and not asking when they should leave, or even asking when they should go. I think that the presence of and the commitment of white persons to first their own liberation and then to the liberation of the continent and finally the universe is still a source of hope for me. And then, of course, I really don't think that there's anything wrong with white people. Every black person in America should own about 40 of them.